Hi, everyone. This is Camden Busey. Before we begin today's episode, I want to invite you to join us in person at four upcoming events. First, on August 4th and 5th, Carlton Wynn and I will be at Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary near Greenville, South Carolina, for their summer seminar, where we will deliver a series of lectures on apologetics and evangelism for the pastor. Then, August 28th and 29th, we're heading to Birmingham, Alabama, for a seminar at Cahaba Park Presbyterian Church called Discovering Christ in All of Scripture. This is a Friday evening and Saturday morning, exploring how every part of the Bible reveals God's redemptive plan in Jesus Christ. On September 25th and 26th, we'll host our annual theology conference at Lakeland Church in Gurnee, Illinois. This year's theme is the covenant of grace, one Savior, one people, one purpose. And we're delighted to welcome Dr. G.K. Beale and Dr. Marcus Minninger as speakers. Early bird pricing ends August 31st, so register soon. And then mark your calendars for February 19th and 20th, 2027, when we'll celebrate the 1,000th consecutive episode of Christ the Center. We'll host this in Austin, Texas. There'll be a live recording, a shared dinner, and conversations with longtime friends of Reformed Forum at the Hilton Austin downtown. Seats for each of these events are limited, but more information and registration is available at reformedforum.org/events. We'd love to see you there. Now on to our episode. Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode 968. My name is Camden Busey. As usual, I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, at the Reformed Forum headquarters. And I'm happy to be back in the studio, but connected to people from really kind of all over the country. We've got some from SEC territory, two of us from Big Ten territory, one from what used to be the Pac-12 territory, but his heart's with us in the Big Ten country. I'm happy to have a bunch of friends here for somewhat of a free-for-all episode. We're going to be talking about a wide range of topics. Let me go top left and clockwise on my screen, at least. First, we have Derek Bright. Derek Bright serves as a PCA minister down in Aliceville, Alabama. Welcome, Derek. It's good to see you. How you doing, brother?
Hey, glad to be here. Yeah, doing well. Glad to be with these other brothers.
Yeah, we're gonna see. This is kind of like we're missing Job DeLumba. I wish Job was here because we'd really really crank up the Royal Rumble vibes here. And, you know, maybe every 2 minutes we've got a new podcast entrant. We just have to figure out how someone gets thrown out.
Yeah. Over the top.
That's right. That's Lee Hutchings we have, who serves in North Canton, Ohio, the PCA church. Is it Trinity? Forgive me if I'm forgetting the name. Yeah.
That's right. Trinity Church, that's PCA. That's what I thought.
And Lee is now a board member here at Reformed Forum, and very thankful for that. So, Lee, welcome to the program. We're glad to have you.
Great to be here. Thanks, Camden, and great to be with you guys.
And we also have our dear friend, Dan Borvin. Dan serves as a URC minister out in Anaheim, California. We joked he's a not-so-crypto-Presbyterian in the United Reformed Churches in North America. Dear brother, Dan also co-hosts, along with Chris Gordon, the Abounding Grace Radio podcast. We love what you guys are doing. We love your program. And thanks for joining us, Dan, even though it's outside of the Festivus season. Thanks for joining us.
It's always Festivus season, year-round. Greetings from the People's Republic of California. It's great to see you. Fellow Americans,
we're probably three steps behind you in Illinois, as you know, but not as bad.
Our governor has better hair than yours.
Yeah, he's a lot. He probably could beat Pritzker in any physical activity.
Maybe a hot dog eating contest. You guys would win.
Speaking, the 4th of July, that might be the one thing. That we'd have an edge on for you, but who knows? These guys all want to be president, but they're not.
If it's not Festivus, can we still do the airing of grievances?
Yeah. Oh, year-round. I'm the bishop of Festuvia, so I will grant a special dispensation. We can air grievances year-round.
I got a lot of problems with you people. You're going to hear about it. That's what Reformed podcasting is.
Well, on that point, I think we might you know, on, in terms of some topics we have sketched out, nothing, we don't have an agenda. We've got some potential ideas. As we're recording, it's July 10th, Friday, July 10th. This will probably be airing on Friday, July 17th. But we're several weeks removed from General Synod and General Assembly, the General Assembly season. So we can talk about what's going on. We have three representatives / federations somewhat represented here on this panel. We've also had some recent trips and maybe some upcoming events as well. I was just in Rome for Rome Scholars and Leaders Network, and I was able to present some papers there, and been doing some work on the Pope's encyclical, and have some new episodes coming out down the road, or at least scheduled, on that topic, talking about the church and Christians and AI and technology and the economy, all sorts of wild stuff. The Pope gets into all of it. So hopefully we can talk about a variety of things, and it'll be of great interest and benefit to everybody. But maybe since I attended the PCA General Assembly, I'm wondering, Derek and Lee, if you might just paint with a broad brush or a narrow brush, whatever you want, with as broad strokes or as much detail as you'd like, just your general experience of the PCA General Assembly this year.
Since the SEC hasn't won a national title in a little while, I'll defer to my brother, Derek. He can go first.
Yeah, well, broad brush, I thought it was a really good assembly. There were a lot of things that I felt were positive, and I think this year, at least from my perspective, was even different as far as the spirit in the room. And you saw that reflected even in some of the speeches that were made. There were a lot of really good speeches, even ones that I disagreed with. I thought were really good speeches. In fact, I texted our mutual friend Matt Adams. He made a speech on the floor in favor of the AI study committee, and I texted him and said, "Great speech. I'm still voting against it." But it was a really good speech, and I felt that way throughout. I thought, there were a lot of really good speeches made. There wasn't a lot of, I didn't feel the tension in the room got very high. And, you know, there's something about getting with brothers in the denomination that you don't get to see that often. And it's kind of like a family reunion with a little business attached to it. Yeah. And so I left very encouraged. I think one of the things about General Assembly that I try to tell new guys in our denomination, because it's easy to get frustrated if you see things go in a certain way that you don't like. And I always tell them, Presbyterianism sometimes means you lose. But that's okay, because it also means sometimes you win. And that's kind of what makes, that's kind of the wheels that help this thing turn. There's a lot of give and take. And I felt like this year, the issues at stake, I guess you could say it that way, I felt the way that they were argued, the way that we moved through things. I felt like it was a really good example of Presbyterianism.
Yeah. What about you, Lee? What did you think?
Yeah. I echo everything Derek said. I thought there was a great spirit of unity. There were a lot of encouraging reports, but I served on the Overtures Committee, which one of the unique features this year was that the Overtures Committee had roughly 90 overtures to deal with. On average, each year, between 30 and 40 is usually the number of overtures debated and deliberated on. So this year saw a huge increase, and yet I thought even in the Overtures Committee, which is not live streamed, and I've been on overtures before, even those arguments, the speeches for or against, and even some guys I would notice would stand up and say, would try to help someone's argument or procedure, even though they, again, just like Derek said, probably not going to vote for it, but perfecting the language, helping. There was just a really tremendous spirit. And I thought, even a lot of the big press or talk leading up to the GA was, what was the PCA going to do about the deaconess overtures and female deacons? The brother who wrote the overture and spoke both in the committee and then on the floor, because he was the author of it, so he was given the privilege of the floor and overtures. I appreciated even him standing up and say, this is what I believe. And even in his speech, he talked about, well, here's biblically my exegetical argument. Again, I disagree with his exegesis and I disagreed with his argument, but I appreciated it wasn't an appeal to the culture. It wasn't an appeal to, well, we've got to make people feel, it really was, I disagree with it. But I also appreciated he had the courage of his own convictions. And he was clear. Hey, this is what I think. And that's what you want in Presbyterianism. You want someone says, I think we should do something different. You do it out in the open. You know, you do it and you try to, we have amendments and you can change our BCO. So it's always an encouraging time. GA is an extrovert's paradise. And so, you know, you see everybody and you want to hang out with everybody. But then you realize now that, you know, you're over 40, you can't stay up as late and get up, you know, it's a long week. I was very encouraged by hearing the reports and even the thing that we were talking about, you know, would we get done on time, right? Our moderator this year, Mel Duncan, who, I mean, if you know Mel, to know Mel is to love him. He's such a gentleman. Yep. He handled himself with some people.
Even during Clickergate.
Yeah.
He was charming. He was very efficient and helped keep us moving. And we were done by dinner on Thursday night. Wow. And the over under would have been like, you know, we're going to be here till Friday, which has happened in the past. So even with the highest amount of overtures and some controversial issues, the assembly, you know, worked through its business, I think, with efficiency, but took the appropriate deliberation that it needed to. And so I came away very refreshed and encouraged.
I sat through a few minutes of the overtures committee, and I was curious coming into this. Obviously, my denomination, the OPC, is quite different in how we handle this. We have a different culture. I think we had three or four, maybe two. I don't know. We usually like four would be a very high number of overtures for us. Right. And they come in different varieties, but it's just not typically our culture to try to speak to the whole through an overture. Usually an overture is something that's been worked out, vetted. It might come from a session, then it gets changed and broadened and tweaked at the presbytery, and then it might get sent around to other presbyteries, and then it might come to the General Assembly. So it's not the kind of thing where you have 90 some of them, where you have 17 of them that are basically about the same thing. It doesn't happen. So I'm curious what people thought about how the Overtures Committee handled it. And, you know, you hear whispers, I hear people commenting and talking on the floor at PCA General Assembly about, you know, how these get combined, handled, sent back. Like, it was pretty ruthless, but you almost had to be in order to get through 92 or however many there were. You know, I wonder if people are dissatisfied, if they were happy with the process. What are your general thoughts on how that worked out?
You know, I thought I was overall encouraged. I mean, as Derek said earlier, part of being Presbyterianism is we're predicated on disagreement, accountability. And yeah, sometimes you don't get your way. But you know what? That's why I'm Presbyterian and not an Anglican rector or priest, is that I don't trust myself to always be right. You know, I want the plurality of leadership and wisdom and brother elders who can correct me. And so I think it's healthy. So sometimes, like, I heard some people saying, oh, we're getting too litigious, we got 90 overtures. But you know, there's another part that says, hey, if there's an issue, and some of it may be needed, maybe some of it's a little you know, mundane, or you're just like, you know, let's not waste time with this. But overall, a lot of them I thought were, you know, even the ones we said no to, it's the right of the process to say, hey, we think a change should be made. And I think that can be a healthy sign. Again, if you're just sending up overtures because you want to fight or be controversial, that can get contentious. But you know, you mentioned I heard some comment and feedback. We wanted the overtures committee on the deaconess overture, which is overture 37 from Pacific Presbytery. We voted as a committee 115-14 to answer that in the negative. And originally, it was asked to refer back to the presbytery, but we felt like we needed to send a clear statement to say, no, this is where the PCA is on that. And then there were about 12 or 14 other overtures who were related. So how we got through our business in 2 days was answering a lot of subsequent overtures in reference to 37. Now, some guys tried to pull some out of, and it was debated whether it's an omnibus motion or not. But so some guys weren't thrilled that there were some things that we wanted to look at. And even some guys from the floor GA tried to pull out an overture from Mississippi Valley about functional female officers. But I think that the clear message was still, this is where the PCA stands. And I think whether you pass an overture or not, Cam, that's your point. I think you guys in the OPC do a good job. You know, you can pass all the overtures you want. It's got to still pass, 60 presbyteries. And even if you get it in the book, If someone isn't following the book, then it's really a question of enforcement. Yeah. So again, I could pass, right. We could pass an overture that says every teaching elder must wear a bow tie, you know, or something like that. But that's only as good as it, if you actually do it, and then if you enforce it. And so some of it involves, you know, holding men and brothers accountable for just following. And, you know, I appreciated even in our presbytery, we've had some guys who've come into our presbytery. We've had some candidates leave our presbytery because they found other denominations maybe that were more egalitarian. And I told them, I said, hey, hats off. I appreciate we're not claiming to be the whole kingdom. And so if rather than trying to change the PCA, going and finding another denomination, people say, oh, that's schismatic. No, I was raised Lutheran, and I realized convictionally I was not going to be a good Lutheran pastor, and I needed to change and join the PCA as a Reformed confessional. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it's good. I think it's healthy. It's messy, and, yeah, it's sausage-making at times, and if you're not familiar, it can be overwhelming. But
I thought Guy Waters did such a great job of presenting in the General Assembly this year. The organization level and how that was handled was really impressive. And I think we're entering into a phase, and I heard Ligon Duncan talk about this recently. I think we're probably getting into a phase where if you really want to write an overture, there needs to be a level of expectation that this could actually pass presbyteries. Mm. And otherwise, it's going to get cut. And it's just so I think we may be I think the ballooning number of 90 overtures may be a good thing for the future, because we cut so many that it's almost if you're going to write one, it needs to be good. Mm-hmm. And the last comment I'll make on everything is just going back to the women deacons thing. What I kept thinking all week was, especially about the man who got up and he wrote the overture and made his argument, I thought he showed ecclesiastical integrity. Because he's going about it the right way. And I told my church and I told some of my buddies, I said, look, I can minister in a denomination with that guy. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not a guy that I'm concerned about, because he has ecclesiastical integrity. And I don't know that I could say that about every GA and all the issues in the past, but I was really encouraged by that this year. So kudos to him. Yeah. And that, you know, the way he went about it. So
if I could ask, since you guys address female deacons with Overture 37, do you suspect overtures next year related to the functional female officer issue?
I'll be shocked if there are none. I mean, I would expect some. I think it because of what happened this year, I would expect some to be changed and maybe adjusted a little bit. But yeah, I know what Derek thinks. I'd be surprised if there aren't overtures about that.
I think that'll be there'll be overtures about that probably for the foreseeable future, if I had to guess, because, you know, we're always going to be trying to get at with the culture of our denomination. We're going to be trying to get at the root of the thing. And for some, it's probably never going to be enough. And then for others, you know, there's going to be a stopping point and say, look, we've done this. We've beat this dead horse. You know, it comes down to what Lee said earlier. Like, are we actually going to enforce what we believe or not? And I think that's the big issue. The PCA has a mechanism to deal with things. We just are really poor, I think, at actually enforcing it. And a lot of that is and I've talked to Camden a little bit about the cultural differences between the PCA and the OPC. You know, being a Southern church and for predominantly Southern, you know, it's a Southern denomination, and there's a lot of the good old boy, but in the right spirit, you know, but we're all buddies. We all went to seminary together. Or I know this guy and we don't want to do that. And he means what, so we can tend to shy away from maybe doing some of the harder work when the mechanism's already there because of the culture that we're.
If we were to caricature things, now this isn't always true, but if you had to caricature some of the difference between the OPC and the PCA, and I don't see either of these characterizations as good either way, the PCA at times, you know, historically they're evangelical Presbyterians and Presbyterian evangelicals, to use Sean Michael Lucas's characterization in his history, and I agree with that. but it's the desire to keep this tent broad, and you're confessional, and you have your standards, and they're good standards. But yet when people start stepping out, the tendency is like, no. You do everything you can to try to keep people under that tent. Whereas the far side of things where, you know, and I'm not proud of this, but generally speaking, historically speaking, in the OP, we're much more comfortable with just drawing a line and say, see you later, you know, or, and that's not a good tendency either. We don't want to see people leaving, but if we've got our standards, we're sticking to them. And if you want to be outside of that, then we're way more comfortable with that. And I think going too far in either direction is not good, but that's one man's assessment of things from a broad lens, a wide lens.
I think that's fair. That's fair and accurate.
Yeah. Yeah. Yankees have much more, they're much more comfortable with, being rude. And
I just want to know where I stand, right? Dan, do you agree? The Midwest is different.
I lived in Mississippi for 10 years, went to seminary at RTS Jackson. And I used to say, well, I'm from Northeast Ohio originally. I used to say, in the Midwest, we stab you in the front.
Dan, tell us about the URC General Synod. Were you there? And what generally happened?
I was there.
Yeah.
It was kind of boring, which is good.
That's good.
I think we didn't have, it was nice to have. I'll tell you the worst thing first is that we were in Canada outside of Calgary.
Yeah.
And
that's the worst thing. We're going to have to do some damage control here. I don't like where this is going.
I don't know if you guys are aware, but that country has declared war on tobacco.
Oh.
So we tried to, of course, part and parcel with any ecclesiastical assembly is smoking cigars when you're not working, or if I would like it, while working, we're smoking. So the first day we were at a hotel outside of Calgary, and the first day we had a special bypass that we found a courtyard at the hotel. We were able to smoke out there, no problem. That was great. The next day, guy from the hotel comes out and says, sorry, we can't let you smoke on the patio. It's illegal in the entire country of Canada to smoke on any public courtyard or patio. So we could stand 5 meters from the front door. We said, meters? What are you talking? What is this strange? Meters? Is that like cubits? What are you talking
nobody
about?
Nobody knows.
But we don't know. So I pace it off. Anyway, we had to stand like hobos out in front of the hotel, freezing. And here's the other thing. It was 50 degrees and windy. I said, when do you guys have summer? So we're out smoking in the front of the hotel, freezing. So that was the worst part of Synod. Which, if that's the worst part, I'll
not
take
that bad.
It. You know, but we need a tobacco-friendly setting. I think the organizers next time need that has to be a major factor. Is the setting tobacco-friendly? We can't go back to a country that has declared war on tobacco.
Yeah, we have similar problems at our assemblies because we often have them at Christian colleges, universities. Our arrangements committee does a tremendous job trying to work things out. So there's been more than a few times where we have had an offsite kind of meeting place, either the president's house or another administrator. We had someone, a dear friend of many on the arrangements committee and a friend to the OPC, opened his home to the commissioners and others who wanted to come after hours. And so we had great times of fellowship at Geneva College. But on campus, not just in the dorms, but even in the public spaces, none of that stuff because of their campus policies. And I understand, but it does hinder things. You'd think that there might be different policies for outside events rather than when school's in session or something, but I don't run these schools and I'm not the attorneys. So this is not my purview, but this is a feature. It is an issue.
So I will take offers. I will take offers from any guys in tobacco country. I know that one benefit of the South, talking about the PCA, the Southern denomination. Yeah, you're in tobacco country. So if anyone wants to make a generous offer to me, you can pay me in tobacco, not in metrics, but I do standard.
I'm sure there's some obscure form or set of measurements that only applies to the tobacco industry.
Tobacco and bourbon, I'll be happy. Calvin got paid with barrels of wine. I think casks of bourbon and humidors full of cigars is a great way to compensate a pastor. Well,
and maybe if you,
it was not for nothing,
enough,
we had our assembly in Louisville, Kentucky.
That happened.
That's true.
There was something else.
Maybe if you smoke enough packs of cigarettes, you could get a Geneva gown with like the marble emblem or the camel symbol on it. Yeah. I mean,
like NASCAR, you can get all kinds of advertisements and sponsorships.
That's right. Yeah.
I got to cash in my Marlboro Miles.
Yeah. Tell me about your call package. Well, look at my Geneva robe here. I've got this patch from, you know.
You guys know Tyler Frayer? I don't know. He's an OP minister out in Dayton, Ohio now. But a couple years ago, I don't know how this even came up in conversation, but our algorithm, our YouTube algorithm suggested to us some really crazy, weird videos. It was this guy. It was almost like a modern day Robin Leach, kind of like a Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. But he has a YouTube channel where he likes fine cigars and like custom suits and custom shoes. And it's just this weird, strange combination. But peculiarly fascinating. It's kind of like not exactly like a car wreck, but you're like, I don't know why I'm so enthralled by this, but I can't look away. And so this guy went to Savile Row in London, which is the world famous kind of center for bespoke suits and all this kind of stuff. And so what he would do is he'd go and get like a custom suit, and then he would go to the Davidoff store in London, and he had a dear friend there, and they would regale and talk. It was almost like an SNL skit. Like, these are characters. They aren't real people, it seemed like. But they're real, but it seems like this can't possibly be the way people really talk. They're like, oh, Kirby, thank you so much for coming to our store. I'll send links so you guys can watch this. But they went to the cigar guy, said it would be a dream of mine to own a suit from Savile Row. And so the guy set him up with a tailor at one of the famous shops. And he had his custom suit made with custom pockets for his fancy cigars. So this can happen, and I'm sure that they'd be able to cut a Genevan gown for you if you ever wanted one. Probably have to pay £15,000 for it, but it's but it could work.
I need a custom made Geneva gown with cigar pockets. You just gave me a new idea. Brilliant.
You're going to be your new business that you can run on the side, Dan. Well, in terms of the OPC General Assembly, just a couple things. It was a wonderful time of fellowship. We're very thankful to be at Geneva College and thankful for their hospitality. Couple points, high points to mention. I would refer people to the PresbyCast episodes. Chris Drew did a great job of kind of reporting on some of the things that happened there. I don't remember if Daryl was on that episode too, or whether what I listened to on a podcast and then my podcast and then in private conversation is starting all to blur together in my mind. So I don't know what's real and what is, or dreams for that matter. I don't know if I'm awake right now. But we erected a study committee to study Christian nationalism. Some of the members of that committee, it was contended that some people on social media and other places weren't happy with the members, but it should be noted those were elected. They were not appointed by the moderator. So these are by far some of the big vote getters. So in a sense, that just is the way that your church kind of spoke about what they thought about female deacons very clearly with a vote, the way we elected our participants on this study committee, in a sense, I think we'll see the report, but you know, it speaks volumes in terms of what the church as a whole, or at least the commissioners at this assembly, who they wanted to think and write about this matter. We did agree after a long debate to sign on to the ARP statement. Our friend Ben Glasser was critical in drafting and writing. There was great contention on that, not because anyone's in favor of these topics or kinism or racism, but the OPC is generally very reticent to make statements beyond our confessional standards. It's just something that's not typically in our culture. A lot of the arguments against signing on to such a thing were just procedural and cultural, not principally, you know, against the statements. But we signed on to that, so that went through. And then we had several challenging appeals and complaints, and business went really late. Like, we had some really, really tough stuff. And as you guys know, we deal with everything. We have advisory committees, standing committees and advisory committees that do their best to try to take work off the floor and away from the floor. But we we deal with all of our judicial cases, all the appeals and complaints come before the entire assembly in one way, shape, or form. And some of those took a really, really long time. And so there was just overall, I would say it was really wonderful to see the brothers. It might've been the most difficult assembly I've been to. I've been to 11. I haven't been a commissioner at 11, but I was a commissioner this time. And yeah, we went to 11, I think 11:30 PM one night, and we're working from 8:30 AM to, you know, 8:30, 9 o'clock PM every day, even Saturday. Just the Sunday is the only day we're off. So it's a long, long week. And this one was rough, but thankful to the Lord.
Do y'all have any worship services, Camden?
Yeah, we do. Not the way that you do. Like we have daily devotionals. We have an opening worship service. Then we have two services on the Lord's Day. A lot of times the morning service will try to disperse and go to local OP churches. We have buses and shuttles that take us different places. We often will do kind of a joint service in the evening rather than going back to those churches in the evening. And that's generally what we do. And then daily devotions. So usually for about half an hour before lunch, somebody presents a sermon / homily devotional kind of message. And we sing hymns and psalms when we come back for every break. It's not worship service, but those are elements that we have as part of our assembly. You guys do that at the URC? Something similar to that? I can't recall. Yeah.
Yeah, we do before every break.
Yeah.
After every break, we do. It's called devotional.
It's a very continental sermons. Thing. You guys love that. I mean, you always love the devotional.
We love singing message. Psalms. Yeah. Can't go 10 minutes without singing a psalm. And so, you know, when you're on hour 12 and it's like, dude, you got to land the plane. We don't need a 45-minute sermon right now. Read a psalm and pray. But no, it is very edifying. And I'll tell you, everybody says, you know, one of the best parts of Synod, and you guys know with GA, is hearing so many men sing hymns and psalms to God together. Yeah. It's really moving.
Right. It is. It's a wonderful thing. Dan, I wanted to get
you. I got distracted by the tobacco talk, but we too, just for those unaware, we too in the URC signed on to the ARP statement on race and kinism and all that. So
I was about to ask.
It's very encouraging to see. Yeah, it's encouraging to see so much of NAPARC united on this issue. We all could have submitted individual statements, which would have been fine. But to me, the fact that we're all united on this is much more powerful.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we're glad that this is, I hope, not a growing issue. I hope we can squash this and get rid of this nonsense because it's atrocious. But how we get there is going to take some time, and we need to be faithful and pursue the Lord and speak the Lord's truth. And
it's just like you said with sanctification. And just like with the issue of female deacons, the real rub comes with men enforcing this stuff. We can make all the statements we want, but if men don't have the courage to enforce this in their churches, it's going to be all for naught.
Dan, I also wanted to speak with you just a little bit about my recent trip to Italy. You gave me a report about all this. So we have a mutual friend, Andrea Ferrari. Yes. Pastor Dr. Ferrari, who is a
unrelated.
He's a Reformed pastor in Perugia, which is in the territory of the state. I don't know if they call them states, but basically the region of Umbria, which borders Tuscany. So only American tourists know Tuscany, but Umbria is bordering Tuscany. It looks just like it, and it's just cheaper, and it's gorgeous. So I visited him for a few days, and then we traveled together down to Rome, where I attended the Rome Scholars and Leaders Network, which is put on by the Reformanda Initiative and hosted at the Breccia di Roma Church. So our brothers there, people may know from their podcast, the Reformanda Initiative podcast, Leonardo DiCirico, Reed Carr, Clay Kennard, really wonderful brothers, and I was really glad to see them. I'd met Leonardo in person at the Reformed Colloquium in Budapest before, but this was the first time I met Reed and Clay, even though I've been listening to them for years, and I had a wonderful time. But Dan, I would love to just get your impressions again about your previous times in central northern Italy. So this is a couple hours north of Rome. And just your thoughts about the Reformed Church there, because Andrea's laboring there. There's another Reformed brother, Mike Cuneo. And then a little bit further north, I think up in Milan is Mike Brown, URC minister. And you've been multiple times. You've been going for years. So tell me your thoughts. And I'm curious to now hear these again, but now with the perspective of having been.
Yeah, we don't want to forget Vincenzo Coluccia
Yes.
is down in Lecce.
Yeah.
He's a PCA MTW missionary there. Lecce is the heel of the boot. So it's about as far south as you can go. So we have... we have the whole country covered for Presbyterian and Reformed churches, just not much in between with Milan and Lecce. But yeah, I've been going to Italy probably 15 years or so. I lived in London for a couple of years and in England total for 5 years. So traveling to Italy from London was very easy, affordable and quick trip. So I got to go, I don't know, 3-4 times a year. And got familiar with the Reformed work there. And it's slow, obviously, but very exciting, very encouraging. And one of the most encouraging things that I was not aware of until a few years ago is the Brazilian Presbyterians
are
swarming Italy. They have, I don't know, 10 or 15 churches. Mm-hmm. And it's not just with Brazilian expats. They're reaching the local Italians. And the Brazilian Presbyterians are very aggressive with church planting. Mm-hmm. So they're doing some amazing work for the kingdom. And Mike Brown, our URC missionary in Milan, is working closely with them. And they're in talks of, they hope, forming a Presbyterian denomination in Italy. Mm-hmm. Now, the timetable on that, who knows? But the fact that that's on the table is astounding. Knowing the history of Italy and the history of the Reformation in Italy and how brutal the Italian Inquisition was and all that, the very fact that a Presbyterian denomination is a possibility is an amazing act of providence.
Mm-hmm. I played some odd language games, so I'm very privileged and blessed to have these opportunities at times through Reform Forum or the OPC or other means to go visit places, speak to people, get to know missionaries in different countries. And I don't take it for granted. Even watching the World Cup this summer, you know, often I'm watching and I know people at both countries. So while, you know, Colombia is playing, who were they just playing recently? Switzerland, you know, I can text both of my missionary reform friends in these countries and, you know, tell them both I'm rooting for their teams, I guess. No, like, but it's really something just to see and to get to know people, to see what the Lord is doing, not just in terms of the evangelical church, but even more specifically Reformed confessional works in these different countries. But Dan, I was on the square in Perugia with, we're in Assisi. Andrea took me up to Assisi to go see St. Francis's, you know, basilica and go see all the stuff. We saw the tomb and you do the things. All these pilgrims are coming from around the world and it's very superstitious. You know, we're not into the superstition or all of that stuff, but we went to go see it regardless. And on the square, we ran into some friends of his that are Christians that were Brazilians. And I can't speak Italian and the Brazilians couldn't speak English really well. And, but I could speak Spanish and then they know Portuguese and they could speak Spanish well enough. So it's like, what is going on? But it didn't quite feel like Pentecost, but it was a shadowy form of this where it's like, I'm in Italy speaking bad Spanish and the Brazilian, expat-ish is interpreting and, you know, understanding my Spanish through his Portuguese. So whatever. But this is, and it worked. And this kind of like, I think the Reformed mission work in other countries in microcosm, it's like, you just got to go with the flow and make it work. And the Lord often blesses that.
Well, it's just amazing how small the Reformed world is around the world. You know, you can know people from all these different countries and try to communicate together. And even though it's not perfect communication, the amazing aspect is the mutual bond of the Holy Spirit that you know you possess.
Yeah.
You're meeting family members for the first time.
Yes.
That you're all part of the same family, bound together by the Holy Spirit. I've had that experience so many times and it always blows me away.
Yeah, you meet people for the very first time in a foreign country, and there's something mystical about it. And I mean that in the best of senses. I mean, it's a true spiritual bond that is so evident and palpable, and we don't get that sense, you know, when we're at home so often, or we're dulled to it, and it's sad. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I was going to ask you guys, because I love hearing about this. I can't imagine what it's like for the Reformed Church in mm-hmm. Italy, the cradle of Catholicism and all the history. And, you know, in some ways, even as you're describing going to Assisi, like, you know, it's like what Luther visited Rome and saw all the practices and a lot of that. But like, what's it like, or what were you seeing? What were your experiences, Camden, being over there mm-hmm. and just going to Rome as a Protestant and Presbyterian and meeting with believers there in that land?
Yeah, thanks for that, Lee. It's challenging because you do get certainly the sense that it is the Catholic Church. That's the way they present it. Like, there's for people in Italy, generally speaking, Christianity and Roman Catholicism are identical. There is no conceptual understanding for anything else. And anything that isn't Roman Catholic is kind of just viewed as not just sectarian, but like a cult. Like it must be right. Like Mormon. So if you're Reformed, they don't really see much of any difference between Reformed confessional people and Mormons, Jehovah's Witness, you name it, just go down the list and same thing.
That's right.
And it's a major challenge. So these brothers that I met with, and then the Rome Scholars and Leaders Network is doing tremendous work through the Reformanda Initiative to do apologetics and evangelism to Roman Catholics of all kinds. I mean, we're talking priests all the way down to nominal Catholics, people that haven't gone to Mass in years or ever, whatever. And just speaking the truth. Breccia di Roma is the name of their church, and it's a wonderful group of believers, but that means the breach of Rome, and it alludes to an historical moment. There was like a hole in a wall where they would pass Bibles through in Rome, and we should have these guys on to talk a bit more about the history there, but they're actively advocating for preaching the gospel of God's free grace, the death of Christ as a payment for our sins, and his resurrection from the dead as our justification and our full salvation, and preaching that and speaking that unashamedly, and comparing and contrasting what Rome is teaching with what the Bible teaches, and getting things back down to the basic level. So I very much appreciate their assessment of Roman Catholicism historically and contemporarily. You know, I've done my work on Karl Rahner and post-Vatican II Catholicism, and that's kind of what I'm more familiar with, along with, you know, the Catholicism of my neighbors growing up and that sort of thing. But I'm thankful for them because they're very sober-minded. And even, you know, as Leonardo often says, and he's written on this subject, they'll often use the same words, but they're coming from a different world, and there's a completely different meaning. So it's even dangerous to presume that what many Roman Catholics mean by confessing the Nicene Creed, for example, is anywhere in the ballpark of what we mean by that or what the Bible is teaching about that. So I think it's important to be reminded of those things and not to be, we always need to be antithetical, but I mean, you always want to be optimistic in terms of an understanding of the Lord's power to meet and reach people. So you don't want to stress the antithesis so much that you never engage in apologetics or evangelism, or become kind of like a caricatured hyper-Calvinist. You'd say, well, the Lord's going to call who he calls. I'm not going to talk to anybody or proclaim the gospel. That would be a false conclusion from Scripture in my estimation. So they're actively engaged, but they're also, as I say, sober-minded. They understand the antithesis, and they understand that you have to get down to the foundational level and preach and proclaim Christ crucified for sinners. And at the end of the day, it really comes down to an issue of authority. We see that even with, you guys seen this Society of St. Pius X, this SSPX news that came out last week? So going back to the 80s, there was a guy named Bishop Michael Lefebvre, or Lefevre, we might say in America, Lefebvre. Basically, they're kind of like what the Presbyterian Constitutional Covenant Union was with Machen back before 1936. in broad strokes. So they're a renewal movement, like an affinity organization within the church, who views the whole of the church having been lost to modernism. And so they despise this Society of St. Pius X, despise the changes that happened at Vatican II, 1962 to 1965, and they see it as a liberalizing movement, and they want to renew the church and bring it back to her previous faithfulness. So they're in favor of course, the Latin Mass and things like this. So Bishop Lefebvre was previously excommunicated, and along with some other people. During Benedict XVI's time as Pope, he reinstated many of them. But just last week, the guys that are in charge, the bishops in charge of this society, announced they were going to consecrate four new bishops. And if you know anything about Catholic polity, you can't just do that without the approval of the Pope and the whole college of cardinals, the college of bishops, the collegium. This is a highly contentious issue, and they're saying, we're just trying to be faithful, and we're going to consecrate these new bishops. The Pope said, Pope Leo XIV, no, don't do that. Please don't do that. If you do this, we'll have to excommunicate you. You can't do this. And eventually they did it. They were excommunicated. And they said, well, we're just being faithful, and we will believe that in future years, another Pope will recognize us once again. And that was their conclusion. So they're very different from the Presbyterian Constitution Covenant Union, of course, because of our confessional standards. But whereas Machen and this group tried to reform the church from within and were not able to, were eventually deposed and suspended from ministry and removed, they started a new church. But for a Roman Catholic, that's inconceivable. You can't possibly do that. But yet they recognize that popes come and go, and they'll just wait for another day when another pope will see the truth and accept them and come over to their side.
If the next pope is a Cubs fan, maybe he'll be
he might receive them. But it's wild. And I mean, it just reminded me again of really at the end of the day, anything goes theologically, really, within Roman Catholicism. There's room for everything, but the one thing it can't flex on is not only the understanding of authority, but tied up with that authority and the ecclesiology therein, it must come back to the Pope, because the Pope is the vicar of Christ. He's the head of the church on earth. And that's so significant because they view the church as the ongoing incarnation of Jesus. And so therefore the head of that is equivocally the Lord. I mean, in terms of authority, it's nothing different than the Lord on earth in the flesh, declaring things. So that, if you boil it all down, boil everything down, that is at the heart of it all. And so what you think, what we think, you know, I've met people, they know I'm a confessional Presbyterian. I had a warm reception from a brother I had interviewed on the podcast 8 years ago. Well, a priest that I'd interviewed on the podcast, a really friendly guy. And he invited me to go with his family to the excavations under St. Peter's. I couldn't go, but it was like, man, these guys, these Roman Catholics know that we're Reformed, but they're so welcoming and so friendly. And a lot of it, I think, has to do with just the post-Vatican II mentality. You know, the Catholic Church views that there are basically anonymous Christians, that the world itself is a sacrament. And even if you, Dan and Lee and Derek, are going off doing what you do and you have your own thoughts, you don't know it yet, but you're just an anonymous Christian. You're an anonymous Catholic. You know, you're under our tent and part of our group. You just don't know it yet. And one day you will. And so there's this welcoming kind of presumption to everyone. There's this judgment of charity that I think is fueled by this universalizing theology of grace, along with their ecclesiology. And I think if we don't say those things out loud, and if we don't have those in our minds, it's easy to get swept up in stuff and not understand what's actually going on in our Reformed and Catholic apologetic evangelistic encounter, you know?
Yes. About a year ago in Northeast Ohio, there's a strong Catholic presence in our area. And a year ago, I attended a funeral. And afterwards, the family introduced me to the priest who officiated and celebrated the funeral mass. And they said, you know, this is Lee. He's a Presbyterian minister. And the priest couldn't have been more gracious and happy to talk to me and thanked me for my calling. Almost talking as if
encouraging your ministry.
And saying like, oh, thank you. And he was very polite and kind, and we had a good conversation. And I think you're right. It's important, particularly, you know, anytime we come in October and Sunday school classes or sermons preach on the anniversary of the Reformation, it's always important to remember, we need to be charitable and understand, like, the Catholic Church does not just simply teach salvation is by works. They teach salvation is by faith plus works.
Mm. That's
it's
right.
Not just saying get you to heaven. It's Jesus gets you to heaven plus your due. It's not just, they don't reject salvation by grace.
No, not at
they
all.
Reject salvation. Grace alone.
That's right.
Why the solas of the Reformation are so critical and crucial. But because if you talk to your Catholic neighbor, they'll say, we believe in Jesus, we believe in faith and grace, and we believe in the Bible. And so we need to be honest about what the church actually teaches, both Rome as well as our Protestant and Presbyterian traditions.
If I could just add about the factions, you know, like you said, they're all united in the Pope. They love to throw at us, oh, there are 30,000 Protestant denominations.
Yeah.
Well, there are 30,000 different factions within the Roman Catholic Church.
Yeah.
So the only thing is they pretend that they have the one head that unites them all, but they're just as divided as Protestantism is.
Oh, yeah,
they are. And I think that's the sham or the fool. Like, if people get frustrated with evangelicalism or even just Reformed Protestantism, and for those reasons, and then they want to go back either to Rome or to Eastern Orthodoxy because they think it's a more faithful, steady, sure thing, I think you'll be sorely mistaken when you actually end up in Rome and you see how many differences there are, how divided it is. There's a formal unity because they'll say we're connected to the Pope, and if they don't, they'll be excommunicated. But other than that, that's the level of unity we have. We much prefer to have a unity that's based on truth and based on what we profess. So that's why we recite things like the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed. And, you know, we have confessional unity and we have an understanding of the universality of the church, but it's through what we believe and it's through our Savior, not through any earthly institution.
We've got in my congregation, even here in a small one red light town, we've got a handful of converts from Rome. That are really solid members, and we just brought one into membership within this year, just a few months ago. And I remember the first time meeting with her, and I went out to lunch with her and her fiance who grew up in my church, and I thought, Protestant Catholic dating, like, we gotta, you know, I'm gonna have to talk about this. But she had been attending every other Sunday. She'd go to mass with her mom on, you know, and then come to my church. And I thought, this is going to be, and I regularly talk about the differences when we recite the Apostles' Creed and things like that. And so anyways, we went out to lunch and she said, I need help fleshing some things out. And she goes, can I tell you what I believe? And you tell me where that lines up. And I said, yes. And she goes, I believe that salvation is by grace through faith. I don't believe that the mass is the actual body and blood of the Lord. She's like, I reject transubstantiation. And she was born and raised, worked in the church, you know, as whatever her volunteer position was, you know. She wasn't just a nominal Catholic. She was, you know, even how she dressed was related to being part of the church. I mean, she was probably could have been on her way to nunnery at one point if she really wanted to be. I think, you know, she didn't want that, but and she said, I reject the authority of the Pope, and she named off all these things. And I said, and she, I mean, she was emotional about it. And I said, you know what it sounds like to me? She said, well, I said, sounds like you're a Protestant and you just need to go ahead and just admit it. And we went through membership classes and she was the best student, but she is all in and growing in leaps and bounds of her faith. And one of the things that was so encouraging to me was she said that one of the things that drew her into becoming not just a Protestant, but joining, you know, our little PCA church was the amount of scripture that was either read or expounded upon. And it made my heart just well up. In fact, it is right now just thinking about, man,
our differences really do matter, and there really is spiritual life to be had for people. And it's such a beautiful thing to see people come from darkness into light. And, you know, it wasn't this, you know, I walked an aisle, I asked Jesus into my heart kind of thing that, you know, it was, she had been studying the scriptures. She had always, in her mind, and I think truthfully, she probably always trusted Christ, but didn't have, always had some inconsistencies in her mind about how the church lined up with those things. And it just took the faithful reading and teaching of the scriptures and, you know, going through doctrines and light bulbs going, yeah, that's exactly right. Christ's death is sufficient for me. You know, this is enough. And, you know, it was, I always had questions. Why, you know, why purgatory if Christ accomplished it? Like, why this? And then, you know, and so I let her hit me with a bunch of different texts, and that would be kind of the, you know, the classic text for what Rome says they, you know, not that they have a good text for everything, but, you know, what about this text? What about this text? And she said, I've got, somebody finally gave me answers. Now that's not because I'm smart. I'm not, but it's more of just the fact that, like, man, there, the text is there, and it's just a beautiful thing when, you see people just have their eyes opened. And so I just wanted to share that by way of encouragement to the listeners there that, you know, it's praise a beautiful thing. And so
ex-Catholics make great Presbyterians because they know grace and they know assurance of salvation as well as anybody.
Yeah, that's right.
It's a great point. Well, I do want to give people, you know, a preview of some things coming up on the program in future weeks. I have some podcasts scheduled where we'll be pulling apart and taking a deep dive at Leo XIV's encyclical Magnifica Humanitas. So this was just published a few months ago, but Leo's encyclical turns Catholic social teaching towards artificial intelligence and the human person. He's writing this clearly and explicitly in the line of Rerum Novarum, especially, which is Leo XIII's encyclical, which kind of introduced this idea of Catholic social teaching. So I have some guests lined up down the road where we will be speaking about this encyclical from a bunch of different directions and perspectives. I think it's significant. So if people are interested, read the encyclical. Get prepared, but we're going to be speaking about it with a Reformed believer who is an economist at Grove City College, Sean Rittenauer. We've got a Christian technologist lined up. We've got an ethicist lined up. And so this encyclical, I feel like Stefan here. This encyclical has everything. It's got all of it, all of it. I mean, it talks about transhumanism, posthumanism, artificial intelligence, you know, human dignity, labor. He argues GDP is no longer a good measurement for human flourishing of societies, like you name it. Like this Pope, Robert Prevost from Chicago, is going to town.
White Sox fan.
Yeah, we don't like that. But the Pope is nonetheless issuing quite an initial salvo. So there's a lot there that I like, but I was telling the guys even off mic, the diagnosis of the problems, not always, but in some cases, is actually quite good. But his solutions are not great from a Reformed perspective, or even just take that out of the mix, even from my own personal thoughts about society and business and personal responsibility and all sorts of stuff, you know. So we're going to pull that apart. Something a little different we haven't done a whole lot of here at Reform Forum, but I think it'll be interesting, and it's certainly on the pulse of issues going on. We really are living through an enormous cultural transition, and it's only, I think, going to accelerate in the next couple of years. But artificial intelligence is, if you thought the internet changed society, artificial intelligence is going to touch everything. And so I'd like for us to think wisely about it, critically about it, and really be more conversant, not just have a knee-jerk reaction. It's all great. It's all terrible. Like, let's think about it and what it is and how Christians ought to engage with technology. Just as a preview, if you're interested, even from a biblical theological perspective, the Pope issues two cities and two loves. He's an Augustinian. So you have the city of God and the city of man, and those are defined by two different loves, either love of God or love of self. But then he says there are two biblical narratives that really describe what's going on with AI and big tech. One of them is Babel, Genesis 11, you know, the building of the Tower of Babel, the ziggurat to the sky and human autonomy. We're going to become gods ourselves. And this is what actually many of the heads of these AI frontier companies are actually professing. They talk as if they are creating God, an omniscient, omnipotent being that will solve all of our problems. This is not me exaggerating. This is literally what they're talking about in many cases. So we need to think about this critically. But then the other biblical case, as Leo introduces, is the rebuilding of the walls in Nehemiah. So he advocates for, you know, human dignity and human flourishing, where we all live together in a society of love and work together to build a better society. So that's more or less his kind of utopian vision. So where we fall down upon that, I'm sure there are many different acceptable reformed answers. I'm not saying there's one right answer necessarily, but what I hope in the future episodes is for us to get a handle on the issues and think about them Christianly, biblically, and according to our reformed creeds and confessions. So have you guys read this at all, or knew about the encyclical at all? Did you have AI tell you what it said?
I haven't read it, but going back to what you were asking about earlier, our GA kind of recap, Derek alluded to it. And, you know, one of the unique things about General Summit this year is we already had two study committees out, a study committee on Christian nationalism and what, if any, or how making our directory of worship constitutional. That's one of the sad, unique realities of the PCA is we do not have a constitutionally binding directory of worship, or at least a full directory. So we have a rule, in order for there to be a third committee, that these two both asked for another year, and they were granted another year to complete their work, was a proposal for a committee on AI. Mm-hmm. In order for that third committee out there, it had to receive from Derek, like two thirds. The assembly had to approve it, and they did. And you know, there's, you know, I on my bingo card for GA was you know, someone saying from the Mike study committee fatigue, and I usually vote no on study committees on principle, but this was one where I think, you know, obviously one of the arguments against it was by the time the PCA finishes a study committee report, I mean, AI has changed. I've been told, I'm not an expert, but even the last 6 months have seen a tremendous change. What are we going to say? But not so much a crises on the technology itself, but where are the biblical and ethical boundaries, you know, and, you know, like, can you, you know, when you're teaching Sunday school or preaching or whatever, what's a boundary marker of using AI? Where is it okay? Where is it not okay? And so I do think in that sense, I'm hopeful that whatever the study committee for our denomination comes out with is just to say, like, hey, you know, and I appreciate, you know, the Pope even writing about this, because I think it's something that touches all of life, any nation, any culture, any civilization. Again, the people I've talked to, this the possibilities for it can be scary. But where are there possibilities to harness it, you know, for good and encouraging? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's all way over my head. But I'm thankful there are smart people. So I haven't read the encyclical, but I plan to keep up with all the. Maybe you can get the Pope on Reform Forum.
I didn't think about that. Amazing. I'll call him.
Email Dominic. Call Clegg, Cardinal and say, well, we're ministering. Yeah, we're men of Chicago. You could say that, like, we're men of Chicago. So let's discuss over a slice from Giordano's or something, and have them
Lose,
on.
Yeah, whatever. Gino's, you name it.
A couple.
We
got to
find out which one's his favorite first, Dan. Right? We don't want to off put him. We got to find out
That's
his affinities.
That's a big debate, almost as violent as Catholic versus Protestant.
Or Ohio State versus Michigan.
Don't start.
Okay. So, Derek? Yeah, a couple thoughts. One is I'd appreciate the Pope at least making an effort, because one of my aggravations is that it seems the church is always so late to a lot of things.
Yeah.
And we're responding to things that, you know, we're 5-10 years too late on. And
right,
So I at least appreciate that, because AI and technology in general is just changing so rapidly and advancing so rapidly that I think we do need to have something out there. I would just say that, and you're probably going to deal with this in your reform, you know, in your stuff on it. But, mm-hmm. I think we've got to begin with a good, sound, maybe recovery is the right word in some sense, anthropology. I think for so long, what it means to be human and anthropology, all that was taken for granted. It's even taken for granted in seminaries, as we all agree on this, right? And now we
We found out with Revoice that we didn't. Right?
That's right.
Like, there's vastly different understandings of anthropology with the Revoice issue.
Yeah,
and
that's
concupiscence
exactly right.
And, you know. Right?
So before, and that's the, but, you know, I think we have the resources in the Reformed tradition and the, you know, the broader Catholic understanding. We have the resources for good anthropology, but I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done on that, because in order to address transhumanism, we need to know what human is. I mean, you know, we need to know what being human is. And, I can hear in my mind right now, you know, Lane Tipton talking about the creator creature distinction already. Like, I know this is coming, so I can hear it. So shout out to Lane.
The Catholic Church, even before, this recent encyclical had released Antiqua et Nova, which is a note on the relationship between artificial intelligence and human intelligence. They have these things that are effectively like ongoing committees. I mean, they kind of do work that we would call them kind of like study committees, but they're like permanent, I think semi-permanent committees in the Vatican called dicasteries, D-I-C-A-S-T-E-R-Y. So the dicastery for the doctrine of the faith and the dicastery for culture and education jointly published this article. So if anyone wants to read it, I'll try to put a link in the episode description, but you can find it. Antiqua, A-N-T-I-Q-U-A, et Nova, N-O-V-A. Et is E-T, if you know Latin. And so old and new, if I know anything. And so that's a good resource. And so they are kind of on top of things, but this is not the voice we want to be dominating the conversation. So it's good to read these and to be familiar with them. And we hope to pick this up from a Reformed perspective. So stay tuned to that in coming weeks. If you have any questions or comments, you can hit us up at mail@reformforum.org. We do have a bunch of events coming in the future, and I hope my friends will be at many of them. But we've got a seminar. Well, Carlton Wynn and I will be teaching a seminar in August at Greenville Presbyterian Theological Seminary on apologetics and evangelism for pastors. The end of August, we'll be in Birmingham, Alabama. Derek's doing some great work, and along with our friends at Birmingham Theological Seminary, Ike Reeder and others. And we'll be at Cahaba Park Presbyterian Church for a Reformed Forum seminar meetup in partnership with Birmingham Theological Seminary. Information about that's on our website. And then down in September, at the end of September, we'll have our annual theology conference here near our office, which is in our office in Libertyville. The conference will be at Lakeland Church in Gurnee, Illinois. And then, as I'm calling it, the granddaddy of them all. Think of, we used to talk about, you know, the Michigan-Ohio State game, especially at the Big House, the granddaddy of them all, a summit. We will be celebrating our 1,000th consecutive episode of Christ the Center at the Hilton Austin downtown in Austin, Texas, February 19th and 20th. We've got seats for 300 people, so that'll go quickly. Registration is open and available. Visit summit.reformedforum.org for information on that, but all the links are at the homepage, reformedforum.org. Brothers, thanks for joining me. Thanks for putting up with me. But this has been a really fun conversation. I'd like to do these free-for-all episodes a little bit more often. Derek Brightley Hutchings, Dan Borvin, the Bishop of Festuvia. Thank you. Thank you to your parish and your parishioners for giving you the time and the dispensation to come. And I hope everybody enjoyed this, and hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.